This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
This afternoon, we have two more panels. This panel is on infrastructure politics, and then the last panel will be on content and conduits. So we're really excited that everyone is back here and that these all-star panelists have made it from far away to join us. I'm going to just start with a brief clip. Part of thinking about infrastructure is thinking about visibility and invisibility in many ways, because infrastructure is often invisible. Making it visible has been kind of a theme in some ways of both of our keynotes, and this is just a brief little clip about when the infrastructure fails us, how that becomes visible. So this panel is about the pipes and how they're regulated or not regulated and what that means for us as citizens. And at the heart of this discussion is the issue of net neutrality, or the principle that would maintain a free and open internet and treat broadband as a common carrier, basically requiring that everything that passes through these pipes is treated equally and delivered at the same speed, regardless of who is sending it, which again brings us back to that issue of visibility and invisibility. Nick talked about how in his, that was download speeds, but you talked about how you found out it was 1 megabit per second. Is that true? But you have a little measuring device that you brought with you, right, to make that visible. So we don't all have this kind of, technology with us at all times. Decisions that, going back to the George W. Bush era FCC regarding how broadband is classified and regulated, finally caught up with the agency in January. The recent ruling by the DC Court of Appeals in the Verizon versus FCC case essentially said the current rules that the FCC has do not provide the agency with the authority to enforce net neutrality requirements. And we can get into the specifics of that in a minute, so I'm simplifying. But basically, it gives the invitation an open, or gives the FCC an open invitation to codify those principles into policy and in a revamped open internet order of sorts. So whether or not they have the political will is another thing entirely. So I'd like to get into some of that today, as well as other initiatives and developments like Google Fiber and Aereo, which complicate some of the politics around pipelines and might just force the hand of policymakers in some instances. So I'd like to welcome all of our panelists. I can't believe I got them all in one room. I'm so excited. I'm going to have them introduce themselves and give a brief statement on their own area of expertise and investment in infrastructure policy, and then we can get into questions. So, Harold, I'll start with you.
Okay. So my name is Harold Feld. I'm a Senior Vice President for Public Knowledge, which is a digital rights organization in Washington, D.C., where we care about two things. One, what I like to describe as, ubiquitous and meaningful broadband access, meaning that everybody ought to have it, it ought to be affordable, and there should not be any kind of intermediaries, whether those are the corporate intermediaries or the government standing between you and what you want to do with the with that broadband access.
My name is Zach Katz, currently a fellow at the USC Annenberg Center on Communications, Leadership, and Policy. From 2009 until last summer, I was in government, first at the White House and then at the Federal Communications Commission, where I served in a few roles, including chief counsel to the chairman and chief of staff. Spent a lot of time on the 2009-2010 net neutrality process, and then a lot of time in the years since then on broadband policy, and in particular, getting broadband out to rural areas and getting broadband to low-income folks around the country.
Hi, I'm Danny Kimball. I am at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I'm finishing a dissertation on net neutrality. More specifically, I'm looking at the politics of the policymaking process surrounding the open internet rules that the FCC enacted in 2010. and the implications of that process, and now the court decision that has struck down the heart of those rules. And I'm particularly interested in it as a policy issue that will shape the fundamental infrastructure of the internet, who it's for, what we can do with it, whether the internet remains or heads toward this vision of a participatory system that is here for people to do with what they choose, or if it just becomes, you know, another content delivery system for media industries. And I argue that, you know, however this issue is resolved, and it is far from resolved, and we're going to hopefully talk about that here. However that's resolved is going to make a big difference in the shape of the internet and the implications that has for its role in democracy and a lot of the bigger issues that we're talking about here today.
Hi, I'm Becky Lentz. I'm an assistant professor of media policy and technology at McGill University, but I guess I would consider myself an educator and advocate. So my focus is not so much on trying to influence the policymakers, but to try to build capacity for civil society organizations to do what they do, and also to study what they do in ways that makes that more visible. So I'm really an infrastructure junkie. I like bridges, roads, and sewage pipes. So hopefully we can talk about all that too. And it's just a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Victor Picard. I'm an assistant professor at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. And I do research on the history and politics and normative foundations of media policy. In particular, I just finished a book.
Woo!
I can actually say that. on 1940s media policy. And it was an interesting time where there was a largely forgotten media reform movement, and you had a progressive majority on the FCC, which might be difficult to imagine. And they were able to break up media conglomerates. They attempted but failed to apply meaningful public service responsibilities on broadcasters for them to hold on to their spectrum. So some parallels, a lot of differences with our current moment, but I definitely think that we need to constantly historicize these contemporary media policy problems.
Hi, I'm Sharon Strover from the University of Texas at Austin. I'm a social scientist, and I've always been really interested in how people interact with technology, and I got especially interested in networks and infrastructure when I had an accident and plowed my car into a snowbank in Wisconsin after skiing and had to hike to a little farmhouse to call a tow truck. And discovered that the house had to pay to make long distance calls to their communities where their kids went to school, where all the health facilities were, where they bought their groceries, because of a change in the status of AT&T. And this seemed so wrong to them and to me, and I wanted to find out why. That was more than 20 years ago, I guess. And the questions keep coming up, and the whys do get answered, but new perplexing situations emerge.
Great. It reminds me, your story reminds me that Janet Walker taught us that research is me-search often. So that's a good way of introducing us how we get into studying what we do. You have an accident in a snowbank. Okay, I guess since given the recent news, I mean, and it continues to evolve since you've probably gotten on your planes and gotten off your planes, about the net neutrality decision, I would love it if we could start with that and start digging into your thoughts about this decision and what you foresee as next steps. And please do bear in mind the first time you bring up certain terms and concepts, there are students who don't study infrastructure. So if you could let them into the conversation by, you know, giving a little background, that would be great, or I can step in and do the same. Harold, you have a fairy tale,
That was about something else. I want to illustrate.
Oh, okay.
I do want to illustrate some of the problems around the politics generally. But,
okay.
I'll save that a bit because it's an illustrative little story. If we want to start with net neutrality, I've been involved in this issue since before it was net neutrality. My involvement in what is now net neutrality goes back to to the late 90s, when we were clearly about to be moving off violence. And the history here is actually very interesting. Out of curiosity, how many people here first connected to the internet through a dial-up connection? Okay, so a fair number of people in this crowd still remember dial-up. That's good. How many people at this point are still on a dial-up connection? Okay, that's good. But to illustrate some of the problems around the politics of this, we were in the 1990s pushing for what was not even net neutrality, which is the principle that the network operator, because they are the ultimate intermediary and can mess with things in ways you can't detect, has an obligation to not mess with the traffic. We were actually at that point pushing for, no, the people who own the wires have to open those up and let competitors use those wires to deliver competing broadband service, which was the model we had used to very successfully bring down things like long distance pricing from something that was like monumentally high to something that was negligible and non-existent. So, and was in fact the law for most services until cable modem broadband came along. And then two things happened. One was the agency hesitated because the cable operators were big, bad political players. We just had an election in which the Republicans had taken over Congress. Nobody wanted to look bad, you know, wanted to be anti-business. And two, nobody in the public got it. The routine question I got on why was it important to open up the cable modem service was, who cares? You know, who cares about this broadband stuff and downloading things at 300 kilobits per second? You know, we have 56 kilobit per second modems. There's 6,000 dial-up ISPs. AOL is really the big, you know, gorilla in the room. Why should we care about this stuff? So there was an opportunity there, and then when the Republicans took over, that got lost. They deregulated not only the cable modem service, but the existing dial-up and DSL services. All 6,000 of the competing ISPs that you used to be able to choose from, many of which were going on DSL. Anybody here remember DSL resellers? We used to have a lot of them. That died, you know, and brought us down to our current two without much public notice, because people didn't get it because they didn't have broadband at that point. Net neutrality was the thing that got salvaged out of that disaster. This went up to the Supreme Court in a case called Brand X, where the court said, yeah, the FCC has the right to change the classification of services and say this is something called an information service, which is not regulated in one way, as opposed to a Title II telecommunications common carrier, basically phone-type service, and said the statute has a couple of different boxes. You got the info service in the box and the and the telecom box, and the FCC put broadband in the info box, which meant that all the rules that made it work like a telephone system, it goes where you want it to go, the network operator doesn't get to interfere, we're gone. So net neutrality was kind of the thing that got salvaged out of that, and it was basically just a commitment to principles that the network operator shouldn't interfere with where people want to go, and they shouldn't prevent you from attaching devices like Wi-Fi routers to your broadband service, and they shouldn't lie to you about what they're doing, and you should have a competitive environment. And that was what net neutrality was for a while. To cut this short, because I don't want to give too much background, that became the basis for a couple of legal fights as to how to make those principles actually try to work. And since 2005, 2006, we have been fighting very hard on how to take what was the second choice, having this thing be controlled by the network operator without any competition on the line, but at least preventing them from messing with the user too bad. And how to make that stick in a way that's going to matter. So that's the kind of historical background on the net neutrality fight.
Maybe I'll add a little bit on the more recent history, and particularly taking the focus of this conference, the discussions starting yesterday and today, on the politics of it. I think net neutrality is viewed by many as a purely or largely political issue, or an issue where politics really holds sway. And I think the decisions that the FCC has made on this issue dating back to the early 2000s have often been perceived as dictated more by political considerations than by substance, where substance could be economic analysis or kind of some rigorous policy analysis that tries to determine what's likely to be in the best interest of the country and consumers. My experience at the FCC differs, I think, from that of Commissioner Johnson when he summarized last night some of the concerns about pay-to-play and political influence. I found myself, when I was there, surrounded by a very dedicated group of public servants who came to work every day trying to serve the public interest, developing policies in what's a very fast-moving area, difficult often to predict what's going to happen in 6 months or 12 months in the absence of regulation, much less when you introduce regulation. And the net neutrality rules that the FCC adopted in 2010, at the time, I think, were criticized really from both sides. Certainly folks on the right felt that this was a solution in search of a problem. There was no need to put regulations on broadband providers. They didn't have incentives or the ability to really mess with traffic. They'd lose customers if they did. Folks on the left felt that the rules were so full of loopholes as to be the end of the internet as we know it. And so the predictions, including from Harold's organization and others, was that we would see very problematic conduct in the broadband marketplace over the next 3 years, particularly on the wireless side, where the rules were a little softer than they were on the wireline side. And the concern was that wireless broadband providers would block or play favorites in ways that would stymie consumer benefits, maybe limit freedom of speech, and harm innovation in the economy. And over the last 3 years, although there certainly have been some challenges, I think the broadband marketplace, including the wireless broadband marketplace, has really been a very positive thing for consumers. So speeds have increased, device availability has increased, mobile innovation has increased. There certainly are challenges, including challenges around pricing and getting connectivity to folks in lower income brackets and rural areas of the country. I don't want to suggest that everything is fine. But I think it was an example of policy, certainly politics was weighed, coming to a reasonable outcome that for the last 3 years at least has been pretty positive for the country.
Does anyone? Okay, go ahead, Dan.
I guess I can kind of pick up my understanding of what happened just recently in the in the aftermath of this stuff. The Verizon v. FCC case that you mentioned basically came down to the bitter fruit of the seeds that Harold just described that were planted then, you know, came back up, that the open internet rules were struck down by the D.C. Circuit because broadband service was defined as an information service which the FCC cannot regulate, like common carriage. And Becky's work provides a really great history to that story and how those, you know, the influence of those definitions. But basically, you know, if the court ruling said, even if the rules are good and are a good idea, which it said, it doesn't matter because it's unenforceable without the right definition underneath it. And so, the big announcement that was made when, you know, I was on the plane on the way here, that the FCC is not going to appeal the court decision that struck down the rules. They're going to rewrite the rules based on the same authority that they just lost on, but sort of try it again and see if they can write different rules that aren't so similar to common carriage that they would get struck down because they can't regulate common carriage without the right definition. But this is something I'd like to hear others' opinion about as well, but it seems to me that it's kind of a foregone conclusion that whatever rules we end up getting without being based on a vision of common carriage are not going to be real net neutrality, because that history of how we define common carriage and how we define net neutrality is really the same thing, that common carriage informs what net neutrality is. So if we get new net neutrality rules that can't touch the idea of common carriage or can't get so close to that that they would be frowned upon in court, then we're going to end up with something that isn't a sustainable policy for enforcing net neutrality. And so that's something I found particularly problematic about the announcement that was just made, and would much prefer to see the FCC instead reclassify broadband service as a telecommunications service and just openly admit that net neutrality is common carriage and we need that common carriage definition in the rules.
I kind of want to take what you've said and throw out something a little bit to link back also to what Nick was talking about last night. And I think he was presiding at the FCC and the first or second inquiry, the computer inquiry, where you were dealing with this notion of the separation between content and conduit, which is exciting that this will be our last panel. And the idea that we can get bogged down in all the technical legal details about whether it's common carriage or not, but the fact is that what we want to think about, I think, is the way in which we think about infrastructure. So, for example, there's this really wonderful new book, a chapter in a book by Brian Larkin called The Politics and Poetics of Infrastructure. And I want to just read something that he says, which I find really kind of inspiring. He says, infrastructures are not, in any positivist sense, simply out there, and we know this, but the act of defining an infrastructure is a categorizing moment. And when we think about the categories that really substantiate, you know, the legal practice, and Harold and I have talked a lot about this, it's based in language, and the way we want to define infrastructure and the way we define the services that exemplify what they are is a constitutive type of work that we don't often take into consideration. We talk about the politics of net neutrality. It's really the politics of language in many ways. So I wanted to just throw that out and also talk about how that the students in the room, I think that, and those who are interested in policy and law and technologies, there's nothing, and Sharon was one of my teachers in grad school, used to say, there's nothing inherent about any of this. It's something that is produced by people in the practice of writing law and regulations. And so I want to just throw this out, that we need to be thinking about the fact that in the Telecom Act as amended, in Communications Act of 34 as amended, there is no definition of infrastructure. There are lots of definitions of lots of things, but we need, and I'm just curious for, you know, one of the questions that I think that Nick was dealing with when he was at the FCC was, how do we actually define the separation between these two things that's all really electronic in the first place? And we see that the FCC's history is one in which they can define something one way and say it's this way, and then come back and say, and reason differently by commissioning all sorts of studies, that in fact they might change their mind, and that happened several times. So it could happen that they could reclassify and it could all be, you know, quite different than it is today, and to stop talking about it only in terms of innovation and science and technology kinds of things and competition, but in terms of citizens and consumers and people. So to see the words that the activists are actually placing in the public record in their comments and replies to comments and complaints is really a matter of politics. So I'm just saying the politics of infrastructure are also the politics of submitting these kinds of texts that actually archive this argument.
Yeah, so I'll try to continue some of these threads. I mean, I share the view that ideally we would be talking more about reclassifying broadband as a telecommunication service. And I've been struck by the sort of resignation, even coming from a lot of liberals and progressives, that battle's been lost, that it's fait accompli, that we lost that with the Brand X decision, or we lost that in 2010. So I agree with Becky that we really need to look at the language, the way that these things are being discursively framed, the parameters that are being set, going back to Dess's point about media policy silences. What's being decided from the get-go falls outside, out of bounds? What's something that we can't talk about? And it's almost like there's a push now to make reclassification one of those things that we cannot discuss. It falls outside of the bounds of legitimate discourse. And I think whenever we're talking about the politics of infrastructure, I come at it from a political economic tradition that's always looking at questions of ownership and control, but how those things become naturalized is very much grounded in language, especially when we're talking about something that remains so often invisible. And I don't want to jump ahead because I think we might be talking about regulatory capture at some point, because at that point I have a little bit of an anecdote that actually relates to the Brand X decision, but maybe I'll save that.
Okay,
for
I'll come
now.
Back to you for that.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, just to amplify on that, infrastructure is one of those odd words. It's very cold and sterile, and I think on one hand, we think of infrastructure as referring to hardware, wires, maybe software as well. But in fact, when you consider infrastructure in a social context and in an economic context, it becomes sets of relationships. And I think fundamentally, to bracket off policy from politics is a fallacy in this context, if not in most contexts, for that matter. So while infrastructure seems boring and sterile on the face of it, when you kind of paw down and think a little bit more about what it actually means in people's lives and in the way that industries operate, the notion of infrastructure as something essential, I think, has to rise to the surface, especially when we think of it as something similar to water systems and electricity systems, things that we've defined in many circumstances as essential. This kind of brings out, I think, a critical juxtaposition in the way we think about infrastructure and about the internet or broadband or the network, period. And that the tension is, should the market be the entity that produces this as a service, in control of these wires? Or is there something so essential about it, so embedded in the way we conduct our lives now, that we have to kind of reclaim some control over it?
Which is the heart of what common carriage is there to protect, right?
Absolutely. And that's why the early, the pre-1996, or even earlier than 96, we had a regulated monopoly delivering what was considered essential services. And then in kind of telecom 2, we moved into a deregulatory era in which the market was defining how these things would operate and what indeed was essential about it. And now we're struggling with a third phase, I think, which might amount to reclaiming some of the definitions and some of the obligations that characterized an earlier era.
Mm-hmm. I could maybe just follow up on that. I think one of the most exciting things, and I think it's right to look at this as a third phase in a lot of ways, one of the most exciting trends in that area, I think, is the growth that we're seeing in cities, municipalities, sometimes small towns, building their own networks, partnering with entities to build their own networks, dissatisfied with the broadband services that they're getting from the incumbent cable company and telephone company. So rather than looking at policy, as we've talked about it a lot today, as just a federal issue, I think a lot of the exciting things going on in the communications policy space are happening at the state or local level, or could be happening at the state or local level. And there may be things that federal policymakers can do to help enable that, something Chairman Wheeler at the FCC has signaled an interest in doing.
But there, too, you have to acknowledge that there's been a huge industry effort to limit what's even possible.
In fact, 20 states now have kind of incumbent-backed laws that restrict the ability of municipalities to build their own networks. And I think those are really difficult to square with consumers' interests in the 21st century.
So let me raise a point here. Why is everybody voting against their own interests? Because these are decisions. None of this is, a law of nature. And for a lot of these things, we actually started in fairly good and fairly strong places in terms of consumer protections, in terms of the rights of localities to determine what they want to do for their own infrastructure builds, in a lot of these things. And in fact, here's the shocking things. A lot of times when people actually wake up around this stuff, they win. I've now been in this for a bunch of times, and I have seen, some big fights and a lot of small fights where it turns out, you really can make this democracy thing work. I do happen to agree with Zach in one sense, that a lot of the folks at the FCC are doing what they can to try to do the right thing, or their definition of the right thing as bounded by what they perceive to be the possible. And I do have to disagree to the extent that politics is involved in defining the possible. There is an entire industry that is dedicated to defining the bounds of the possible and the plausible in the political debate. And That's where kind of media literacy and media education and all of this and the very language by which we talk about this, you know, is a critical aspect. But the real things that I've seen are what the hell made 20 states vote to limit their ability to do stuff for their people? What the hell has made nearly every state peel back vital consumer protections on the phone network, which we all rely on, you know, that had been in place for 50, 60, 100 years? You know, what the hell made people think that deregulating broadband, which was, everybody agreed was becoming the essential service, was going to be a great idea? You know, and why the hell do people keep thinking that the world that we're living in now is the best of all possible worlds when we clearly see other worlds that are better, other pieces of other worlds that are better, you know, and continue to feel that somehow, though, if we are dissatisfied and don't recognize that we are living in the best of all possible worlds with the bestest of all possible broadbands ever, that there must be something wrong with us. And I would say that there are a couple of very simple things that I've seen repeatedly. One, it's very hard to know what's going on. How many people here knew when their state was even considering a law to repeal all consumer protections around telephone or broadband or IP-enabled services? You know, we had a big thing here in California last year. California, liberal state, just totally deregulated all broadband, you know, and all broadband-enabled services. Was anybody aware of that last year? Okay, got one.
Jeffrey was, too.
So that's one. The other big thing I've seen is what the hell made civil rights organizations support repeal of anti-redlining rules? That one was a big one. That was 2005, 2006. What the hell happened with that?
Can you tell them what anti-redlining
rules? Okay, so there were rules that we put in place in the 60s and 70s that said, we know that companies don't like to serve places where they don't think they're going to make a lot of money, which traditionally are poor inner city and minority communities and rural communities where it costs a lot to bring the service out and people are usually poor. So we had very strong ones on those for telephone for 100 years. We had strong ones on those for cable for about 25, 30 years. What the hell made states repeal those in 2005, 2006, 2007? And what the hell made civil rights organizations support that? And the answer seems to be, from what I can tell, there is a great shell game. New great stuff is coming, and we wouldn't want to regulate it because look at all the wonderful things that will happen if we just get government out of the way and let the market innovate us to awesomeness. And this old stuff, though, that you're still dependent on before the new stuff comes in, you don't really need that. So you had organizations that said, we want the new stuff. We're being told that redlining is these rules about, you know, you must deploy in all of these places rather than on your own schedule in your own time, you know, are holding that back because these companies don't want to invest. So we want to get rid of those rules because we want the new stuff. Yeah. Well, new stuff didn't show up. Kind of a bummer.
I think that rhetoric of innovation, which is so seductive and so powerful, is what often does us in. And it's worked entirely in favor of a private sector and their own development impulses, because it means the promise is always there. It's always hanging over it. And we've had tremendous innovations, no question about it. But the conditions under which the innovations are both created and then shared with all of us are extremely and increasingly, I think, problematic here as various inequalities appear and as precisely as Harold said, some of what's promised, in fact, never really emerges here. So this whole rhetoric around not regulating the internet because we don't want to forestall innovation is something I think we really need to be very skeptical about.
Yeah, Becky, and then Victor, I'd also like to hear your historical perspective on some of the questions that Harold was asking.
Sure. Yeah, and I want to push back on Harold a little bit, although I agree with you almost on everything. I just think that the notion or the expectation that people should care about what we care about so passionately is also a problem of the fact that telecom and media policy is not considered part of the social policy conversation. We don't vote on these issues. It, you know, I mean, even the environment, which has a regulatory dimension, which is very similar, people can go to, you can go get a degree in environmental studies, you can take environmental policy courses, you can go do an internship in an environmental organization or whatever, because if it's the CR Club or it's the Environmental Justice Fund or whatever it is. That's not the case in this field, and I think one of the issues that we have to face is that the role of the academy in also rendering visible, as I would say, this field as a studies area, and media policy literacy, and also internships and externships and whatever else it is that other fields have that have social policy dimensions. This is never discussed as social policy. And I'd love to be wrong, but public policy schools, public affairs programs, planning schools, they talk about transportation, they talk about water, they talk about infrastructure all the time. This is always the outlier. It's on the edges of everything. And I think that's one thing we need to think about, or we don't really know what is going on because it's not something that we are asked to participate in, except by those who are also very involved.
Great point. Or we don't have people who connect these dynamics or issues to social issues.
And it didn't used to be that way, because in the first progressive movement, the reason why we had very good laws around a lot of these things was precisely because in the first progressive movement, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, these infrastructure things were the focus of social policy. And there was a direct understanding that I needed to have this stuff. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the anti-redlining things that came in the 1960s were all of a recognition of one of the ways in which we have, you know, disenfranchised minority communities has been by denying them the essential tools to participate in society. And that therefore, if we actually want a just society, we must compel these companies to make these tools available, even if they are stuck in stupid stereotypes about who make good customers. And the problem seems to be that we have moved away from that. In every state right now, there is an effort to eliminate or the concept of public utility, which is all about this infrastructure stuff, and to remove telecommunications and broadband explicitly from it, and say we are not harming consumers because you will have the same general consumer protections under these that you. So your telephone and the means in which you engage in basic communications and civil activity is exactly the same as your toaster. That is the problem.
And I just want to throw out there, too, I think that's a really great points to raise in light of Jen raising the point of visibility and invisibility that, you know, a lot of these questions of how infrastructure and policymaking are both working to make this, like, two levels of invisible. It's mm-hmm. like infrastructure is, like, by design invisible, and as you know, we have heard in so many different contexts all day, starting with Des this morning. You know, the policy making process is meant to be sort of removed from us in this invisible way, and so that's that kind of convergence that makes it even more difficult when we're dealing with, like, you know, technical workings of these technologies and, you know, the arcane terminology of, like, well, you know, we should have more people participating in these processes. And, you know, we need to support the work of people like Harold and the great work that he and organizations like his are doing. And it's a difficult rallying cry to say we need to reclassify as a Title II telecommunications service. It's right. it's a hard job. And I feel like that's also part of the design of, like, we're being asked to play on turf where you know, as was said earlier, you know, the discursive bounds are of that turf are sort of out of our not out of our hands in, like, a defeatist sense, but in a, like, it's an uphill battle sense. Yeah. And the one last thing I wanted to say about that too is that this is extra important from the infrastructure angle, because these are things that will enable other things, and even understanding it as consumer rights is kind of giving away a lot. If we're understanding that, you know, what we should be fighting for is access, period, you know, as long as my Netflix, you know, works fast,
exactly,
then we have won the net neutrality battle.
Right.
Like, that's like selling it short, right? I think this is also fundamentally about whether the infrastructure is enabling us to participate in creating our own things and being able to circulate that to people, represent, you know, talking about you know, marginalizing underrepresented communities to be able to represent themselves and share that in a way that's not able in traditional media. That's at stake here in how that infrastructure gets shaped by, you know, the choices that are being made right now.
And Victor, you've written about a lot of these struggles that are very resonant, right, to the ones that we're having now. So do you have any kind of historical perspective on whether it was easier to mobilize the coalitions we've been talking about, or that kind of those kind of difficulties that have been consistent and persistent over time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you always have to be careful drawing historical parallels. Often under close scrutiny, they fall apart. But at the same time, why I think history is so cool is that it reminds us that what we're facing today, the problems we have today, were not inevitable. They were not a natural outcome. Rather, they're an outcome of particular interests winning out. They're an outcome of conflict, ongoing conflict. And so that's why I'm drawn to these moments of conflict. In the 40s, as I mentioned earlier, there was a time where you saw various corporate interests in very clear collision with public interests. And what's interesting is that the discourse has really evolved over the decades. In the 1940s, a lot of assumptions that seem to have been lost in today's discourse were still very much prominent, such as monopoly is a very bad thing. Antitrust can be a very good thing in breaking up monopolies. Also, there was this underlying assumption, and I found this at the grassroots level as well as within progressive policy elite circles, that there were certain things that the commercial media system could not deliver on, that there were certain things that a commercial media system could not provide in terms of democratic requirements. And you just didn't have the market fundamentalism, or what I've called corporate libertarianism, that you have that's so clear, so prominent today. And for just to give one example, in the letters that I examined, like the letters of complaint that were sent to the FCC, they were constantly asking for more regulation. They wanted the FCC to intervene more often. There wasn't really the equivalent of a Tea Party grassroots movement in the 40s like you find today. So there's been this whole paradigm shift. And I think it's important to go back to these earlier moments just to remind us that these bounds, these discursive bounds that we keep talking about, are not natural, not inevitable. They can be changed.
Great. Thank you. A lot of what people keep talking about is this issue of reclassification. Are we going to reclassify broadband under as Title II services that affords it common carrier protections? And so I'm just wondering, from the panel, is this reclassification the only answer as far as ways to get common carrier protections? And if not, what might other avenues be? And is there the political will to even do so? In the interviews I've done, people seem to kind of laugh at me over the idea that there would be political will to reclassify broadband as Title II. But do any of you have any thoughts on that, Zach?
I would leave Harold to talk about the political aspect since he's there in Washington. But my own sense is that the new policy that the FCC is offering is one that they hope will work, and they still have the reclassification if it doesn't. You know, and billing it as something, oh, we're going to deal with this on a case-by-case basis, sounds very safe, and they hope it will pass court muster in that sense.
That doesn't sound safe to me.
But the other answer, of course, what the industry says is competition. That's the answer. But unfortunately, as we know, kind of on the ground, there's very limited competition. I'm in a city, Austin, that has announced that Google Fiber is coming, and my students are wild about this. They say, yes, we all want Google Fiber. But even there, I certainly don't expect Google to be the answer to all of this. Google is very cleverly starting out by saying that they will wire only in the areas where people sign up, and once they have sufficient numbers of people, that's where they will go. So right off the bat, you have not only are we doing the marketing for them by getting our neighbors to sign up so that we have a competitive option, but they're not really offering to cover the entire city. And fundamentally, the jaded interpretation of what they're doing is that they would like to gin up their own system, get a competitive response out of the providers that are there, because it all generates more business for Google. They win, no matter what.
So to pick up, if I can, on Sharon's remarks about Google Fiber. In Austin, we've been talking a fair bit about net neutrality, which is fundamentally about what broadband providers can or can't do over their networks and the services that they provide to consumers and businesses. There's another set of issues that I think in a lot of ways is more important, and that is ensuring that we have robust, high-quality, world-class infrastructure reaching everyone everywhere in this country so that we're not having redlining. As Harold mentioned, we're not having Google Fiber or AT&T walling off the poor side of town and deciding for economically rational reasons that they're not going to build a network there. And so the universal service principles that this country has committed to for the phone network for about 100 years and are now moving over to broadband gets a lot less press attention, in some ways maybe less politicized, but I think is just as, if not more important than the net neutrality debate.
I want to throw out just, and maybe this is a tee over to Harold. I'm not sure that it matters what the FCC does at the end of the day with reclassification if Congress rewrites the Telecom Act and actually strips its authority to even do that. So there's this other move of a layering, and I was just curious how likely those of you who are closer to the D.C. Politics knowing that it's sort of like they want to, there are forces that want to disempower the FCC to actually take this on, right?
I have a saying. Politics is the art of the possible. Advocacy is making the impossible possible. The reality is there is political will for whatever the hell we manage to persuade them that they need to do. Because, and here is another adage, public policy is not about getting people to do the right thing for the right reason. It is about getting them to do the right thing for their reason. And there are a lot of levers and a lot of ways to do this. There are a lot of industry interests other than telephone and telecom companies that are discovering, as broadband moves to be an essential tool, that they care about this. Now, the way this works without people coming in and forming alliances and doing, you know, all that political advocacy stuff and getting their hands dirty and messy in Washington, is that eventually deals are cut by companies and blessed by politicians. Because one of the things that I have been really quite, you know, interested to see are the number of legislators at the state level and the federal level who will say with a straight face to the news, knowing that the microphone is on and thinking that this is the right thing to say, yeah, we're going to get this done because we're going to get, you know, we're in discussion with the industry guys and these industry guys and that, and they will work it out. Because if that is the role of legislators to broker these industry deals, and in the absence of any other thing to the contrary, that is the role of legislators. Our job is to create an atmosphere where that is not viable. Now, as it turns out, there are a lot of different levers on this. How many people here have heard of something called rural call completion problems? How many of you live in a rural area? Okay, like nobody. Good.
Two.
One of the things that turns out to be very interesting is when you move to, you're all familiar with voice over IP, right? That's the internet-based phone service. It looks like a phone. It sounds like a phone, but it's a phone because it uses IP, which means it doesn't actually work. It doesn't actually have the same protections as you know, actual phone service. One of the advantages of this is it makes the technology for doing phone stuff a lot cheaper. One of the disadvantages is that it also means that in rural America, the phone doesn't work nearly as much as it used to anymore. The most fervent red state, anti-government, death to the FCC legislators who are, you know, Tea Party credentialed out to here, suddenly discovered they cared deeply about FCC authority to make sure that their cranky Tea Party elderly guys in rural areas were getting their federally subsidized telephone service on time. Turns out there was stuff that mattered to them. You can leverage that. Is there political will to reclassify this as Title II, or, you know, to use an insensitive analogy, if you will excuse me, you know, in some ways this has become, for many things, the difference between, you know,
same-sex marriage and civil unions, where there's all kinds of things that you want to do under Title II, but we don't want to call it Title II telecom, common carrier, God forbid, so we will invent new ways to describe it. Is there will eventually to do stuff like that? Yeah, if we make it. Is there will eventually to rewrite the Telecommunications Act in a way that is going to strike a new equilibrium that brings back a lot of these essential services into broadband because people and businesses realize they're dependent on them? Yeah, if we make it.
Eventually, what is the timeline of eventually?
Give me a year and a half at the FCC if we can get this done, and give me 5 years in Congress.
But it's interesting. You're tagging it to the Obama administration.
Oh, hell no.
You're not? Mm. Oh, okay.
5 years was not the Obama administration when last I checked.
No, a year and a half.
We're not going to get a telecom act done until sometime between 2016 and 2020. And it's a different dynamic if it's Republicans in Congress and if it's Republicans in the White House, or God help us both. You know, and it may be that we don't do it, and it may be that they screw up and crash the system so bad that we live in some very interesting times. Or it may limp along just well enough that only people at the margin get screwed. Yeah, there are a lot of different ways this can come down. Nothing is predetermined, but, you know, I wouldn't do the job I do if I didn't think there was a winning strategy.
Okay. I have one more question. I've gotten to two of my, 20 questions. This is great. But I'm just going to ask one more, and then I'll kind of make sure that we leave time for people in the audience to ask. But I'm wondering what you see, not to take the thunder from panel three, but I'm wondering what you see as the role of companies like Google or Comcast or Verizon in setting policy, because, you know, basically Google and Verizon wrote the FCC's open internet order in the first place and then sued them for trying to enforce it in many ways.
They did not write the FCC's open
internet order. It became the same principles, right? They said, indecent proposal.
The Google thing, they got burned on that terribly, and they weren't the same principles. Let me tell you, writing the FCC's order was one of the most soul-crushing experiences that I have ever been involved in. I mean, it was absolutely dispiriting and soul-crushing. But Google got shafted early on when they tried to cut their separate deal and got pushed back. It was actually written by AT&T and a bunch of other guys, you know, with us trying to negotiate it. It was.
But the proposals that Verizon and
did not go anywhere.
But weren't they about you can apply common carrier regulations to wireline but not wireless, right? That was one element of it.
It was. I guess the broader point, which is even beyond net neutrality, the influence that large companies, Verizon, Google, Amazon, whoever, have on the process. I think it's a serious and significant issue. And the work that Harold's group and others do, the group that trade associations, like ones we heard from earlier today, representing some of the smaller voices, corporate voices, labor unions, and others, the role that those kind of less powerful interests play in ensuring that decision makers hear multiple sides of an issue, and often there's 10 sides, not just two, is absolutely critical. For folks working in agencies who are overworked and underpaid and certainly under-resourced, when folks can bring information to you and package it up in ways that you can understand, you know, it's going to help you in your decision-making process. And so if you plea to folks in the room who are thinking about summer internships, organizations like Harold's, they really make a difference. And I think the more talent we get, as well as the more funding we get, kind of amplifying those voices and providing really reasoned economic and policy-grounded arguments, the better the decisions that we're going to get, because there's going to be a more balanced, competitive process to make the case.
That's all the time we have for this panel. We have a 15-minute break, and then we'll have our last panel. But join me in thanking the panelists. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.